Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to Session 5, Community Reinvestment Act Developments. At this time, all participants' lines are in listen-only mode. If you require any further assistance, please press star zero. I would now like to hand the conference over to your presenters today, Karen Solomon and Randy Bhanji. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Thank you for dialing in. My name is Karen Solomon. I practice in the financial services group here at Covington & Burling. I've been at the firm for about a year after a long stint at the OCC as a bank regulator. I'm joined today by my colleague, Randy Bhanji. Randy also practices in Covington's financial services group, and we're pleased to be with you this afternoon. Thank you for joining our teleconference series, describing the financial services and regulatory landscape today. Today's installment on Community Investment Act reform is the fifth session in our weekly series. Additional presentations on CFTC, fintech, white collar, litigation, and housing finance topics will be offered in the coming weeks. We're very excited to be able to offer this series to our friends and clients. Before we start with our substantive presentation, Randy will run through a few housekeeping items. Randy?
Thank you, Karen. For those who are interested in CLE credit, today's program is approved for one half of a credit in New York and California. Affirmation forms were linked to in the reminder notice you received for today's call. You'll need to record the affirmation code that we're going to share towards the end of the call and return that completed form to our colleague, Elizabeth Cristiani. Her information is on the form and she'll revert with a certificate of attendance in due course. Another note, we welcome any questions you might have about the content during this program. Please send any questions you might have to Al McManus. His email address is amcmanus@cov.com. And we'll try to answer as many questions as we can, but if we don't get to your question, we'd be pleased to connect with you on an individual basis after the presentation.
Thanks, Randy. In this program, we're going to talk about the current effort by the OCC and the FDIC to revise their regulations implementing the Community Reinvestment Act. We'll begin by talking about the current CRA framework. Then we'll summarize key elements of the two agencies' December 2019 proposal to revise their current CRA regulations and discuss some of the key questions and issues surrounding the proposal. So we'll start with that description of the current framework. The CRA statute is very general. It requires the federal banking agencies to encourage insured depository institutions to meet the credit needs of their entire communities, including low and moderate income, or LMI, neighborhoods, consistent with safe and sound operation. It also requires the agencies to provide written evaluations of that performance in each metropolitan area where the bank has a branch, and to take that record of performance into account in evaluating applications for deposit facilities. To unscramble that a bit, what does that mean in practice, Randy?
Yeah, what it means is that banks are going to be evaluated every few years on community reinvestment, and they should be striving to achieve a satisfactory or an outstanding rating. And if they don't, they would have very little hope of getting regulatory approval to expand their operations through a branching transaction or a merger or acquisition. So, for example, what we've seen is that when it comes time to do an acquisition, having an outstanding rating in the file can really blunt potential criticism about the bank's record in the community that public commenters might otherwise lob in to the approving agency. And not to mention that having an outstanding record of performance can really be a point of pride for a lot of banks from a PR perspective. And conversely, performance that's less than satisfactory can effectively serve as a bar to doing an acquisition in most cases, and can also stop a holding company from engaging in new financial activities. So, Karen, given that this statute, as you described, is so general, do you want to talk about why the CRA has turned into such a complicated thing for banks?
Well, the agencies have implemented that general statute into a series of regulations that they last substantially amended in the mid-1990s, nearly 25 years ago, in fact. The regulations are currently the same for each of the three agencies, but as we'll get into, that may well change soon. The current regulations set forth a series of fairly prescriptive tests that turn a very general statute into a substantial ongoing compliance exercise. The cornerstone of the CRA regulations is what's known as assessment areas, which are the geographies where the bank's performance will be evaluated. A bank's assessment areas include the areas around its main office, its branches, and each deposit-taking ATM.
Right. So wherever the bank has a physical deposit-taking presence. And that means that the more bank's branches are in a given geography, the more the CRA will incentivize banks to reinvest in that geography to perform well.
Yes, that's right. And if our listeners have ever heard of the problem of CRA hotspots, that's what people mean when they use that term. Then, in terms of how the evaluation works, for large banks, which are defined as those with more than $1.305 billion in assets, there are three components: a lending test, an investment test, and a service test. The lending test evaluates a bank's record of helping to meet the credit needs of its communities by looking at its lending activities, including the origination and purchase of residential mortgage, small business, small farm, and community development loans. Consumer lending, meaning auto, credit card, and other secured and unsecured lending, is considered if it comprises a substantial majority of the bank's business. The investment test looks at the bank's record of making qualified investments in its assessment areas, or more broadly, in a statewide or regional area that includes its assessment areas. Under the regulation, an investment is qualified if it has community development as its primary purpose. The service test looks at the availability and effectiveness of the bank's delivery of retail banking services and also evaluates its community development services. Those are the three basic elements, and they're applied to each of the bank's assessment areas.
So, Karen, how do the tests actually work? Is there a dollar amount of lending or investment that needs to be done by the bank to get an outstanding or a satisfactory rating?
So the answer is probably yes at a high level of abstraction, but in today's rules, there is no objective, transparent standard for what the dollar amount is. So it really comes down to examiner discretion and judgment. That's also true for how the bank's performance in different assessment areas and on different tests is combined into bank-wide performance. Of course, there are banks out there for which the three tests I described wouldn't be a good fit, like banks focused on non-retail banking or those that only engage in consumer loans. Randy, do you want to explain how those banks are treated?
Sure. So those banks can request designation as a wholesale bank or as a limited purpose bank, and that designation allows the bank to be tested using a different evaluation method, which is called the Community Development Test, or CD test. And under that test, the agencies will evaluate the bank's loans, qualified investments, and services that support community development in the bank's assessment areas. It's a very different kind of test than, for example, the lending test that applies to large banks, because the CD test doesn't evaluate how the bank's primary lending products are serving low and moderate income or LMI communities. Instead, community development loans and qualified investments tend to be done separate and apart from the bank's main business activity.
So you mentioned qualified investments. Do you want to talk in more detail about what those are?
Sure. So qualified investments tend to be in projects supporting affordable housing and local economic development. The regulations also require evaluation of whether qualified investments are complex and innovative. And there's some guidance with examples of what it means to meet that standard. But in general, there's really no official word on what kinds of investments count and which kinds do not.
Right. So there is a subjectivity and opacity to that part of the CRA regulations as well. One last thing I'll mention about the current regulations is that small banks are subject to a less prescriptive version of the lending test and community development test.
Right. So just to sum it up, the current CRA regulations seem to have a few issues. They can create CRA hotspots in certain urban areas. There's a lack of clarity about what counts as community reinvestment. There's a lack of transparency and objectivity about what amount of reinvestment is necessary to get a given score and how the different tests fit together. There are also problems of administration of the CRA regulations that we haven't yet touched on. So just to name one example, because CRA evaluations are so qualitative and subjective, it often takes a considerable amount of time for evaluations to come out, even years after the period of time in which the bank that's being evaluated, that the period of evaluation has ended. And that means that by the time the bank receives its rating for a given multi-year period of performance, the evaluation might be completely stale and separated from the bank's current performance.
So that's a particular issue for a bank that receives a less than satisfactory rating, because that rating can linger for some time, preventing the bank from, say, doing acquisitions, even if its actual performance has significantly improved since it received its last rating. So let's turn now to the proposal that the OCC and the FDIC have put out. Against the backdrop of the current regulations and the issues that Randy has just described, federal agencies have started doing a hard look at the CRA regime and whether it's working effectively. The reform effort picked up some steam when the Department of the Treasury put out a series of high-level recommendations in early 2018. And then the OCC, acting by itself, issued an advance notice of proposed rulemaking, or ANPR, in August of 2018. Then this past winter, the OCC and the FDIC put out a joint notice of proposed rulemaking to revise those two agencies' CRA rules. The Federal Reserve didn't join the two other agencies in issuing that proposal. Randy, can you explain what that means?
It means that national banks and state non-member banks, which are regulated by the OCC and FDIC respectively, could become subject to a different CRA rule set than state member banks, which are regulated by the Fed, since the Fed's regulations are going to stay as they are currently unless and until the Fed initiates its own rulemaking process to revise its CRA regulations.
And I would add that if the OCC and FDIC move forward without the Fed, which is what looks like it may happen, it would be the first time that I can remember where the agencies would be administering different rule sets, as Randy has described. So the overarching goals of the OCC and the FDIC's proposal are to make the CRA more objective, transparent, consistent, and easy to understand. Randy, would you want to summarize some of the key elements of the proposal that are intended to accomplish those aims?
Sure. So the proposal would establish an entirely new evaluation framework, some of which is broadly consistent with how the current regime works, and some of which is really new. The first thing worth noting is that the proposal would expand how some banks draw their assessment areas. The proposal would keep the traditional concept of assessment areas defined by the areas surrounding a bank's main office, branches, and deposit-taking ATMs, and would rebrand that as facility-based assessment areas. But the proposal would also require some banks to designate what it calls deposit-based assessment areas, and specifically, a bank that receives 50% or more of its retail domestic deposits from outside of its facility-based assessment areas would be required to delineate deposit-based assessment areas in the smallest geographic areas where it receives 5% or more of its retail domestic deposits. The deposit-based assessment areas would be in addition to the bank's facility-based assessment areas.
So what kinds of banks are most likely to have to designate deposit-based assessment areas?
We're probably talking about banks that operate nationwide, but don't have branches or many branches in geographies from which they're getting their deposits. Those tend to be banks with non-traditional business models, but also banks that have traditional products, but deliver them solely or primarily through digital channels.
Do people have an idea of where most banks' deposit-based assessment areas will be located?
No one knows for sure because there's no data out there that shows where banks are receiving their retail domestic deposits from, and banks themselves aren't really collecting and geocoding that data yet. but it's widely expected that deposit-based assessment areas would be located in major metropolitan areas because those are the areas that are more dense and have more bank customers. So think New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Dallas, those kinds of places. The second major change in the proposal is that a bank score would be primarily determined by a ratio that's called the CRA evaluation measure. That would be applied in each assessment area and then overall at the bank level. And the bank's ratio would need to reach an 11% level for an outstanding rating and 6% or better for a satisfactory rating. And what goes into that ratio? Well, the denominator would be retail domestic deposits. So the more deposits a bank collects within an assessment area or overall, the greater the bank's CRA obligation will be. The numerator of the ratio would be a quantified dollar value of all the bank's qualifying activities, including the balance sheet value of retail loans to LMI borrowers and small businesses, community development loans and investments, and the quantified value of services like community service done by employees. Everything would be quantified, basically. And for loans that a bank originates and sells, the bank would only get credit as if it held the loan on its balance sheet for a single quarter, assuming it sold the loan in that first quarter. There would also be a slight gross up to the numerator based on the proportion of a bank's branches that are located in lower moderate income or LMI neighborhoods. The third major change in the proposal is clarifying what would count in the CRA evaluation measure in the numerator. The OCC and FDIC have pledged to maintain a qualifying activities list that includes specific examples of loans, investments, and services that will count. And they would update that list over time as banks request clarity on whether new activities count. And the initial list they put out includes the number of activities that haven't previously been understood to count towards CRA credit, at least not publicly acknowledged as such.
So it sounds like it's the case that the proposal expands the list of qualifying activities. Is that right?
In some respects, yes. But in a few important respects, no, and actually contracts that list. Most prominently, the proposal would count retail loans to LMI borrowers, but unlike the current CRA framework, would not count loans to borrowers in LMI neighborhoods if the borrowers themselves are not lower moderate income or LMI people. And our listeners may have heard that the comptroller has said publicly that the proposal is designed to reduce displacement or gentrification. This is the aspect of the proposal he's talking about. The idea seems to be to remove an incentive created by the CRA for banks to lend to upper income people residing in lower income neighborhoods. The fourth major change to highlight is that banks would be subject to evaluation of their credit distribution under what are called the retail lending distribution tests. The tests would apply to any major retail lending product line, which is a retail lending product line like mortgages or small business loans, credit card loans, or auto loans that comprises at least 15% of the bank's retail originations by volume. In each assessment area where a bank has originated 20 or more loans in that product line over the evaluation period, the bank would be subject to the test. And let's take mortgages as an example of how the tests would work. The tests would look at what percentage of the bank's mortgages in the assessment area were made to LMI borrowers. That percentage would then be compared to the proportion of people living in the assessment area that are LMI and to the aggregate peer performance of all banks lending in the assessment area. And the bank would need to do well on one or the other of those two comparisons. I just want to note that a bank could have multiple major retail lending product lines and dozens, if not more, assessment areas. And if that's the case, the bank would have to pass many, many tests in order to do well on the CRA. It's also worth noting that the distribution tests are at least conceptually similar to the way examiners currently evaluate banks' credit distribution for products like mortgages and small business loans, albeit it would become a little bit more scientific. But the current CRA regulations generally do not subject consumer loans like credit cards and auto loans to distribution tests. So that element of the proposal is entirely new.
And where would all the data for these distribution tests come from?
Yeah, to make those tests work, especially the comparison to peers, the proposal would require banks to collect and report volumes and volumes of new data, like the address of each depositor and the income of each borrower.
Also of note, the proposal wouldn't provide banks with a whole lot of time to do that. So there are transition provisions. First, the effective date of the rules as proposed would be the first day of the first calendar quarter that starts at least 60 days after issuance of a final rule. The transition periods for compliance are a little more complicated than that. So a bank that's not a small bank, for a bank that's not a small bank, the compliance dates would be 1 year after the effective date for compliance with the assessment area, data collection, and record keeping requirements of the rule, and 2 years after the effective date for reporting requirements. For small banks, and that's defined as banks with under $500 million in assets, the compliance date would be 1 year to comply with the assessment area and data reporting and record keeping requirements. All banks would not be evaluated under the new rule until they complete an evaluation period that concludes after the compliance date for the reporting requirements. And then the proposal has special rules for small banks that actually opt into the general performance standards. For CRA practitioners that are listening, this is probably your most immediate issue, because it could be quite a challenge to get systems up and running to collect and report data to make all of these tests that we're describing work.
Right. Karen, the last major element of the new framework that I'll mention is a community development minimum, or a CD minimum. And that requirement would require a bank to do an amount of community development, lending, and investment that's equal to at least 2% of the bank's retail domestic deposits, both at the assessment area level and overall. So I've described a bunch of different tests and how those tests roll up mechanically into a single rating at the bank level, at the consolidated level, is its own interesting topic. But in short, to get an outstanding rating in an assessment area, the bank would need to get that rating under the CRA evaluation measure and pass the retail lending distribution test and the CD minimum. And then to get a satisfactory or outstanding rating at the bank level, the bank will need to get that rating under the CRA evaluation measure applied on a consolidated basis, also get that rating in half or more of its assessment areas, and the assessment area is responsible for half or more of its deposits, and then pass the CD minimum on a consolidated basis. And the final element is that examiners would still be able to adjust ratings upward or downward based on performance context factors, which are somewhat subjective factors that might explain why it was, for example, particularly difficult for a bank to reach a satisfactory rating in a given assessment area or for a given product. And that element is a little bit of a throwback to the current role of CRA examiners in the evaluation process. And it layers this subjective element on top of what would otherwise be a pretty objective framework.
Yes, and it's worth underscoring how many different tests a single bank could be required to pass in order to get a satisfactory or outstanding rating. Some have referred to the proposal as setting forth a single ratio for CRA evaluations. Specifically, they mean the CRA evaluation measure. And that's a little bit of a misnomer given all of the other minimum requirements in the proposal, as you've described. And Randy, as we talked about before, the current CRA regulations differentiate between large banks, small banks, and wholesale and limited purpose banks. Could you speak to what would happen to all of these categories of banks under the proposal?
Sure. So large banks, which under the proposal would be $500 million in assets and up, will be subject to the general evaluation framework that I just described. Small banks, which are those with under $500 million in assets, would have the option to be tested under the new evaluation framework or to just use the existing small bank test. The wholesale and limited purpose designations would not exist anymore under the proposal. Currently designated wholesale limited purpose banks would be thrown into the fire with the large banks and become subject to the general evaluation framework. And what's kind of interesting is that the proposal doesn't even acknowledge that those designations would go away. So that's a summary of what the proposal does. And I think we've also hinted at some of the areas of potential controversy. And before we explore those areas with a little bit more depth, I just want to point out that our CLE materials for this webinar include a one-page cheat sheet that walks through the mechanics of the proposal's new evaluation framework, step by step. And we've heard from people that it's a very valuable reference tool. So please feel free to look at that if that's of interest to you.
Thanks, Randy. The comment period for the proposal closed on April 9th, and the agencies received over 3,300 comments, which is just a staggering amount of input. I think that level of interest reflects the importance of the CRA in incentivizing banks to do certain reinvestment activity, and therefore the CRA's ability to shape how credit is allocated across the economy, particularly to disadvantaged people and communities. It also reflects how politicized the CRA reform effort has become. I think it would be worthwhile for people to hear briefly the types of things that public commenters have said about the proposal. Randy, do you want to describe a couple of points that the industry has made? And I'll mention a couple things that community advocates have said.
Sure. So the industry has been supportive of the idea of the qualifying activities list, and of the recognition that certain activities will receive CRA credit that, you know, either didn't before or it wasn't clear whether they did before. In terms of criticism of the proposal, bank trade associations have said that there seems to be a lack of data, both within banks and at the agencies, to really understand how the proposal would impact the industry, since so many of the inputs in the new evaluation framework would be new. The industry has also been critical of the data collection and record-keeping burdens, and the limited time for banks to comply. More substantively, there's been some criticism about the balance sheet focus of the CRA evaluation measure, which the industry has said undercounts loan originations that are then sold, including to Fannie and Freddie. There's a worry that subjecting consumer loans like credit card and auto loans to the retail lending distribution test might encourage banks to expand into subprime lending that undermines their safety and soundness. The industry has been critical of the definition of retail domestic deposit, which is defined in the proposal in a way that actually includes corporate deposits, so it's a little bit of a misnomer. And wholesale limited purpose banks think the new evaluation framework is completely ill-suited for their business models. I should also mention that while there are plenty of comments from trade associations, the proposal attracted an unusually large number of comments from individual banks, which is a reflection of the fact that each bank really has its own set of CRA issues.
Community advocates have been sharply critical of the proposal in a number of respects, including the following. Community advocates have asserted that the proposal is insufficiently focused on the needs of LMI communities because it allows CRA credit for activities that are not addressed to those needs. Like industry commenters, community advocates have complained that the agencies have offered insufficient data to support the proposal and to enable the public to ascertain exactly how the proposal would affect LMI communities. And advocates have criticized the proposed CRA evaluation measure on the grounds that it would disincentivize LMI retail lending. Advocates finally have argued that the proposal violates the Administrative Procedure Act because it does not substantively comport with the requirements of the CRA statute, and because the agencies have failed to follow proper procedures by, among other things, failing to disclose the data on which the proposal is based. Finally, I think it would be useful to return once more to the Fed's role in all of this. As we said, the Fed did not join the OCC and the FDIC in the proposal, and if the Fed wanted to align with its sister agencies in the future, it would need to first issue a notice of proposed rulemaking and then a final rule. It can't simply skip to the final rule. I see that we are at the 30-minute mark. We do have a question that we'd like to address, but before we do that, let me recite the code that would be used by those interested in CLE credit. So The following is the code to be recorded on the remote attendee affirmation form. Capitalization matters. So, the code is capital G, the number 4, lowercase t, capital O. Once again, CLE code is capital G, the number 4, lowercase t, and capital O. So we do have a question, which is a very interesting one, given the times that we're living in. And the question is, how has the COVID-19 pandemic changed CRA reform, if at all? Randy, do you want to take a crack at that one?
Sure. So I think that there's probably two elements to answering this question. And the first would be as it relates to the rulemaking process and whether that will be finalized. The comptroller actually issued a statement after the comment period ended in mid-April that said the pandemic is another reason why it's important to reform CRA regulations to encourage banks to provide loans and investments and services to their communities. And his statement also said that the OCC is working to issue a final rule during the first half of 2020. So at least with respect to the OCC, it appears that the pandemic has not slowed down the agency's efforts to push for a final rule. And then there's, I guess, a substantive part to the answer as well, which relates to the question of what counts as qualifying activity under the CRA. And in response to the pandemic, the three federal banking agencies, including the Fed, put out guidance in late March saying that when conducting CRA performance evaluations, the agencies are going to consider favorably efforts that banks are making to help their communities weather the impact of the pandemic. So think things like loan modifications, waiving fees, and making investments that support access to healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. I will read the CLE code one last time. Capital G, the number 4, lowercase t, capital O. And as we mentioned at the start of the program, this is the fifth of our teleconference series. We hope you found this to be of value. We hope you'll join us over the next few weeks, including for a presentation given by our colleague Ann Termine next week. Ann will focus on recent developments at the CFTC, including an update on that agency's response to COVID-19, proposed CFTC rules, and enforcement trends. You can find additional information about our financial services teleconference series on the events page of our website, which is www.cov.com, and on our COVID-19 toolkit page. Links to both are included in the meeting materials. Again, thank you for joining us today. If you have any questions following the call, please feel free to reach out to either or both of Randy and me. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.